I call this meeting of the Property Tax Division to order pursuant to Rule 10.01. The first order of business is that we will need to roll call to determine who's present. The clerk will now take the roll.
Chair Joaquin?
Present.
Chair Joaquin, present. Vice Chair Greenman? Vice Chair Greenman? Representative Hertas?
Here.
Representative Hertas, present. Representative Anderson?
Here.
Representative Anderson, present. Representative Becker-Finn?
Here.
Representative Becker-Finn, present. Representative Fisher?
Representative Fisher, present.
Representative Fisher, present. Representative Gomez?
Present.
Representative Gomez, present. Representative Green?
Here.
Representative Green, present. Representative Hassan? Representative Hassan? Representative Marquardt?
Marquardt, present.
Representative Marquardt, present. Representative Mortensen?
Present.
Representative Mortensen, present. Representative Pulowski?
Present.
Representative Pulowski, present. And Representative Torkelson?
Present.
Representative Torkelson, present. Chair Joachim, quorum is present.
Thank you, Mr. Erickson. So thank you, everyone. I want to make note that all the committee documents for today have been sent to members and are on the committee page on the House website for those of you who want to follow along at home. The first item on the agenda is the approval of minutes from January 13th. Representative Gomez, have you had a chance to review the minutes?
I have, Madam Chair. I'd like to move their approval.
Thank you. Does anyone have any question about the minutes? If you do, just use the raise hand function or star 6 to unmute if you're on the phone. Seeing none, we'll move on to the vote. And this is a voice vote, so members, please briefly unmute yourself when you vote. All those in favor of approving the January 13 minutes, say aye.
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 All those opposed? The motion is approved and the minutes are adopted. The main agenda item for today is the House Research and House Fiscal Staff Overview presentation of the Minnesota property tax system. This is going to include many of the different timelines that property taxes entail, as well as different property tax credits and state aid programs. We're going to take some breaks in between the presentations so folks can ask questions in certain issue areas. So I'll start out with Ms. Schill. Could you please introduce yourself and start whenever you are ready?
Good afternoon, Chair Joaquim and members. For the record, my name is Kathy Schill, House Fiscal Staff. Today we have for you an overview of property taxes. And as we get started, let me make a comment. We have two documents for reference available on the website or in your packets. The first is the 2021 property tax briefing, which is a copy of the compilation of slides of today's presentation. The second document is the 2021 property taxes handout, and this is a collection of reference documents that provides more subject matter detail on topics presented in today's slides. So let's begin. In Minnesota, the governance of property taxes is a shared responsibility between the state and local governments. While property taxes are a mainstay of local government finances, Minnesota's property tax system is highly centralized at the state level. Beginning with Minnesota Statutes 270C.85, state law gives the Commissioner of Revenue the responsibility to oversee key elements of Minnesota's property tax laws, many of which will be discussed this year in committee. So next slide, please. So slide 2 is an outline of today's property tax presentation. I will begin with a bird's eye overview of state and local tax revenues and a review of fiscal resources. Next, Jared Swanson from House Research will discuss components of the property tax system, including its administration, design, and sample property tax calculations. The third section covers state-funded property tax relief programs. Mr. Swan and I will talk about major state aids and credits, and then Sean Williams will discuss property tax refund programs. And the last two segments are local government finance tools. Alexandra Hagler will review local sales taxes and tax increment financing provisions. Next slide, please. So how much revenue do state and local taxes generate in 1 year? This chart summarizes all state and local taxes collected in Minnesota for fiscal year 2020. The size of the entire pie of state tax revenues totals $37.4 billion. About $26.7 billion, or 60%, is collected from state tax sources, and $10.7 billion, or 40%, is from local tax sources. Now, looking at the five pieces of pie here, the light blue section is individual income taxes, generating the most revenue at $12.1 billion, or 32% of the total. The orange area is property taxes at $10.5 billion, or 28% of the total. Statewide sales taxes, the gray area, bring in $7.4 billion, or 20% of the total. And other state taxes, the yellow area, this includes corporate franchise tax, gas tax, excise taxes, collect $6.4 billion, or about 17%. And the last skinny dark blue slice is other local taxes, mostly sales taxes, which generates the remaining 3% at just under $1 billion per year. Next slide, please. So how are state and local tax collections changing over time? A quick measure is to look back at income, sales, and property taxes over the last 10 years. The bar graph here shows revenues from each of these big three taxes for fiscal years 2009, 2014, and 2019. Each tax type is a different color. Blue is for income taxes, yellow for sale taxes, and the gray for property taxes. Choose a color and then following the bars from left to right, you'll notice that each progression illustrates strong revenue growth over the decade for each one of these revenue sources. As these revenues grow, so does the size of the pie in each given year. But there's one thing that's not easily seen here. As the size of the pie of state and local tax collections grows, the revenues from these three big three sources as a portion of the total collections is gradually shrinking. In fiscal 19, these three big taxes were 81.2% of the total. In fiscal 2009, 10 years earlier, they accounted for 83% of the total. And if we look back even further to 2001, they accounted for approximately 85% of total state and local tax collections. Next slide. Bills that change tax laws require analysis for their potential impact on tax collections. Here are the fiscal resources that we use in division and in tax committee. Revenue estimates, this is the most common tool used. All bills heard in committee will have a revenue estimate, which is an analysis that discusses changes in state tax revenues or state expenditures for property tax relief programs are proposed in a bill. A revenue estimate identifies any proposed changes in a bill by making a comparison to the most recent economic forecast. Official revenue estimates are prepared for by the State Tax and Property Tax Research Division in the Department of Revenue. Revenue estimates are reviewed by nonpartisan fiscal staff for each hearing to check if it matches the intent of the bill and for fiscal impact. Revenue estimates can be prepared for confidential estimates. perhaps you'd be formulating a bill and don't know its impact. Please ask fiscal staff, either me or my colleague Cynthia Templin, for help. Analysis remain confidential until bill language is formally introduced. The next tool is a fiscal note. A fiscal note estimates the administrative cost of a program or operations of a state agency. It is different from a revenue estimate that's prepared by the Department of Revenue in the fact that a fiscal note is prepared by one or more state agencies impacted by the bill, and the fiscal note process is administered by the Legislative Budget Office. Sometimes a bill can have both a revenue estimate and a fiscal note. If you're uncertain about the revenue or cost impact of your bill, or you need assistance, once again, please ask me or my colleague, Cynthia Templin. One more thing. Generally speaking, most taxes and tax relief programs are based on the calendar year or payable year, which spans from January 1 to December 31st. While the state budget is done on a fiscal year basis, starting on July 1 and ending on June 30th of the following year. Revenue estimates and fiscal notes reflect fiscal year impacts for use in the budget process, while other documents, even parts of this presentation, show certain calendar year impacts of a program. Now, the third item on the list is local impact notes. Local impact notes estimate the local government or school district fiscal impact of proposed legislation. It can be requested only by the chair or ranking minority of the Taxes or Ways and Means Committee in the House. LBO coordinates the process with input from local officials, which may take many weeks to complete depending on the complexity and the response from local officials. And last, our legislative tracking sheets. Tracking sheets are prepared by fiscal staff to show a collection of cost information from proposed changes in a bill. Done for the governor's budget recommendations, and they're done for omnibus bills in each the division and tax committee. Tracking sheets show baseline expenditures from the most recent economic forecast and proposed changes. The next forecast update will be the February forecast released at the beginning of March. The division spreadsheet tracks property tax refunds, aids and credits, and other property tax relief items. The division report eventually merges with the tax revenue spreadsheet to make one multi-page tracking sheet. Tracking sheets are posted to each committee website and on the fiscal analysis webpage. And now I will turn it over to Mr. Swanson for some information about House research and the discussion on property tax administration.
Madam Chair and members, Jared Swanson with House Research. Before we get into the property tax administration information, I just want to briefly mention some of the services that the House Research analysts on this committee can provide to members of the committee. So we are nonpartisan staff, and we work with members from both parties on a confidential basis. We can provide the committee members with legal and policy analysis on any legislative ideas that the members may have. We can draft bills and amendments for members. We prepare the bill summaries for committee hearings. We also have the capability to model income tax, property tax, and state aid proposals. And additionally, there are publications on our website that are of general interest to many of the topics that we cover in this committee and many of the topics that you'll see in this presentation today. So we're going to take a look at sort of an overview of property taxes. And what I'm going to cover on the next few slides will include how property taxes are administered and calculated. We'll go over some of the features of the property tax system in Minnesota, and we'll talk about how the state provides some property tax relief to taxpayers. So beginning with property tax administration, there are a number of people who are involved in the administration of property taxes, And we'll start with county and local assessors. So the assessors value property and determine each property's classification. They also send valuation notices out to property taxpayers. The county auditors maintain official property tax records. They calculate the tax rates and tax amounts, and they also prepare truth in taxation notices. And we'll talk about these notices a little bit more in a few slides. County treasurers actually distribute the tax back to the local taxing jurisdictions like counties, cities, towns, and school districts. They are involved in a process for tax forfeiture, and they collect the deed and mortgage registry tax. Lastly, for this slide, the Department of Revenue is also involved in the administration of property taxes. There are some types of property that are not assessed by the county and local assessors. So things like utility property or pipeline property actually get assessed by the Department of Revenue. The department also certifies assessments to the counties, and they administer the solar energy and wind production tax. Next slide, please. Taxing authorities are involved in the administration of property tax. So these would be the entities that actually have the authority to levy the property tax and include counties, cities, townships, school districts, and special taxing districts. There are boards of appeal and equalization that exist at the local, county, and state level. And these boards are in place to give property taxpayers a chance to appeal their evaluations. The tax court is an executive branch court with statewide jurisdiction that also provides avenues for property taxpayers to challenge their property taxes. So for example, if a taxpayer were to disagree with their valuation for a given year, they could first discuss this with the assessor, they could appeal to the local boards of appeal and equalization, and if they still weren't satisfied, they could appeal to the tax court. Additionally, the taxpayer can sort of skip all of those first steps and appeal directly to the tax court. Next slide, please. So the property tax cycle in Minnesota actually spans two calendar years. So this slide shows the calendar for property taxes payable in 2021. And this cycle actually began back on January 2nd of 2020. So on January 2nd is when all of the properties in the state have a value assigned to them. In March, those valuation notices are sent out to the taxpayers. There's a process in the spring of the assessment year for taxpayers to appeal these valuations. And then in September, the local jurisdiction set their preliminary levies. Sometimes we call these truth in taxation levies or TNT levies. November, the local jurisdiction sent out notices to property taxpayers, giving them an idea of what their property taxes are going to be in the following calendar year. And these are based off of those preliminary levies that were set in September. Finally, in December, the local jurisdictions certify those levies, so they actually choose a final amount that they're going to levy in the next year. And the in January of the following year, those tax rates and tax amounts actually get computed. In March, the statements go out, and first half property tax payments are due in May. Most taxpayers will pay their second half payment in October, with the exception of ag properties, which pay their second half payments in November. Next slide, please. So the previous slide showed that there are three different statements that get mailed to taxpayers each year. This slide just has a little bit more information about each of those notices. The valuation notice, again, is sent out in the early spring that shows the classification and the market value of each property. The truth in taxation or TNT notices get sent out in November, and those are just notices that show what the taxpayer can expect to pay in the following year based on the preliminary levies that have been set by the local jurisdictions. These TNT notices also have information about public hearings that will be hosted by the local jurisdictions. And these hearings are designed to give the public a chance to weigh in on the levies that the counties, cities, and other local taxing jurisdictions plan on levying in the following year. And then finally, the property tax statement is sent out by March 31st, and it shows the final amount of tax due on the property, and it gives a detailed breakdown of how much money is going to each taxing authority. Next slide, please. So the next three slides, we're going to take a look at how property taxes are actually calculated. At the most basic level, the property tax is determined by a jurisdiction's rate multiplied by the value of each property within that jurisdiction. So to determine the rate within a given jurisdiction, you take the levy divided by the tax base within that jurisdiction. So for example, if you wanted to know the tax rate in Martin County, you would take the levy that Martin County has set for a given year and divide that levy by the value of all of the property within the county. What's unique about Minnesota's property tax system is that there are actually two different types of tax bases that could be that taxes can be levied on, meaning some jurisdictions actually do this process twice and apply two different rates to some of the properties within their jurisdiction. We're going to talk about both of those tax rates on the next two slides. So the first tax base is the referendum market value tax base, and this tax base is only used for school operating referendum levies. However, there was a time where this tax base was used for voter-approved levies more generally. So there are still some of these referendum levies that have not been fully paid off, and a few that had been approved before 2008 are still being levied on the referendum market value tax base. So referendum market value is simply equal to the market value of each property, and this tax base excludes some tax types, including agricultural land and cabins. Next slide, please. So the second tax base is the primary tax base that's actually used to calculate property taxes, and this is known as the net tax capacity tax base. This base includes all property types, and each property's net tax capacity is calculated by multiplying the value of the property times its class rate. This process allows for property tax burdens to be distributed differently, shifting tax onto or away from certain property types. On the next three slides, we'll take a look at the impact of this classification process. Next slide, please. So this slide shows some, not all, but some of the classifications that we have in our property tax system. Note that there are some property types that, like residential homesteads, for example, that have two different class rates. So they have a lower rate on the value of the property up to a certain threshold, and then a higher rate on the value of the property over that threshold. So for example, residential homesteads, which I'll note also include agricultural homesteads. This is something that we often refer to as the house, garage, and 1 acre, or the HGA. This is basically saying that, you know, ag homes are treated the same as residential homes for property tax purposes. So a residential homestead or an ag homestead, just the house, garage, and 1 acre, has a class rate of 1% on a home valued under $500,000. But if the home was valued over $500,000, it would have a class rate of 1% on the value up to $500,000, and then a class rate of 1.25% on the remaining value over that $500,000 threshold. The main takeaway from this table is just that the higher a class rate, the more of the property's value that gets included in the property tax calculation, meaning the property will pay a relatively higher share of the overall tax. Next slide. And this slide just shows a few more common property tax classifications. Again, these are not, this is not a list of all of the classifications. This is just a few more of the common ones. A thing to note is that some property types, like apartments, just have a flat rate on the entire value of the property, whereas other properties like cabins, which is the seasonal rec 4C, have sort of that two-tiered class rate system like homesteads do. All right, next slide. So the effect of this classification system can be seen on slide 16. In this example, there are five different property types. Each property has the same value. So in this example, it's $200,000. If there were no classification system in place, then all property types would be taxed the same, and the gross tax on each property type would be equal. Instead, the property tax system in Minnesota has class rates that distribute the burden differently, shifting tax onto classes with higher rates and shifting tax away from classes with lower rates. So you can see property types like agricultural homesteads or residential homesteads have lower rates, and as a result, they tend to have lower taxes. Properties like commercial industrial properties or apartments, like the rental properties, tend to have higher rates, and as a result, bear a higher share of the overall burden. Next slide. So in addition to classification rates, there's another feature of the state's property tax system that shifts the burden among property types, and that feature is known as a market value exclusion. There are a couple of different types of market value exclusions. I'm just going to highlight one here, and that's the homestead market value exclusion, which is sort of the largest, most widely applied market value exclusion. So the homestead market value exclusion is open to all residential homesteads. And again, this includes the house, garage, and 1 acre of agricultural homesteads. And what this does is it just excludes a portion of the home's value from taxation. The exclusion amount is dependent on the overall value of the home. So you can see from the chart here that the exclusion amount increases as a home's value increases. And it maxes out for homes valued at around $76,000. So the exclusion amount here is about $30,000 for homes valued at $76,000, meaning if you had a home that was valued at $76,000, it's really going to be taxed more like it was worth $40,000. The exclusion phases out as the home's value increases, and it's completely phased out for homes valued at about $414,000. And next slide, please. So you can see the effects of all of these classification rates and valuation exclusions in this chart here. So there are property types like agricultural homesteads and residential homesteads that account for a higher share of market value than what they actually pay in property taxes. And then there are other property types like apartments or a commercial industrial property that pay a higher share of property taxes compared to their overall share of market value. So again, if we didn't have the classification system or market value exclusions, each property type's two bars would be the same. So for residential homesteads, the blue and the yellow bar, for example, would be equal. But the classification system and the valuation exclusions that we have in place shift burdens among property types. Next slide, please. This next slide just shows where property taxes are going. So this the data included in this slide is for property taxes that were paid in 2020. So just over $11 billion was paid in property taxes in 2020. You can see a vast majority of that goes to counties, school districts, and cities. So that's over 85% of property taxes paid to those three jurisdictions. Other local jurisdictions that receive property taxes are special taxing districts and townships. You can see they receive a much smaller share of the overall property tax at 4% and 2% respectively. Additionally, there is a state property tax that is levied on commercial, industrial, and seasonal recreational property. This accounts for 7% of all property taxes that were paid in 2020. Next slide, please. So this slide shows where Minnesota ranks among other states in terms of its overall tax burden. And the measure used here is effective tax rates. So this is the amount of tax paid divided by the value of the property. And this information comes from a report that's put out this year by the Lincoln Institute of Land Policy, along with the Minnesota Center for Fiscal Excellence. And what the report does is it compares property taxes in the largest city in each state, and then it also compares property taxes among a rural community within each state. So the ranking for urban cities that you see here is based on property taxes paid in Minneapolis, and you can see that the property taxes paid by homes, Minnesota's about middle of the pack, a little bit higher for homes valued at at $300,000 for a $1 million commercial property. Minnesota is ranked 10th in the nation for a $1 million commercial property. That ranking drops down to 24th. And then for a $600,000 apartment in urban cities, Minnesota is ranked 21st in the nation. So the rural city that is used in the study for Minnesota is Glencoe. And you can see that the home rankings are comparable, a little bit higher on that low valued $150,000 home. $1 million commercial property is ranked 6th in the nation, and the industrial property is 14th. Lastly, for among rural cities, the $600,000 apartment is ranked 28th. So first, on this scale, first would be you sort of have the highest effective tax rates in the nation, whereas 50th would be the lowest. Next slide, please. So I mentioned a few slides back that there is a state general tax. This slide gives a little bit of information on the state general levy in 2021. So the levy for this year is about $779 million. About 95% of that is paid by commercial industrial property, and about 5% of that is paid by seasonal recreational properties. So this includes things like cabins, resorts, property types like that. There have been a few changes to the state general tax in recent years. So the 2019 tax bill reduced the overall levy by $50 million, and the 2017 tax bill eliminated the annual inflationary increase in the overall levy amount that had been in place since the state general levy was first levied back in 2002. The 2017 tax bill also exempted the first $100,000 of commercial industrial market value from paying the state general tax. So this concludes sort of an overview of the administration of the property tax system. Madam Chair, I understand that this may be a good time to pause for questions before Ms. Schill talks about some of the ways the state provides property tax relief.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Swanson. First, I want to note, just after we took a roll, Representative Hassan joined us, so she's here. And otherwise, members, if you can use the raise hand feature, we'll see if you have any questions so far for Ms. Schill or Mr. Swanson. And I see Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question I think is for Mr. Swanson. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about, I don't know if there's any state where there's front end income sensitivity on property taxes. I know that we introduce income sensitivity through the property tax refund and the renter's rebate, but my understanding in particular of the renters, well, first of all, is that there's a disparity there in terms of the income phase out levels for property tax refund, I think is like 120,000 or so, and the income phase out for the renter's rebate is 60,000 or so. So we're sort of inherently giving more relief to homeowners or those who directly pay property taxes. But my understanding, but obviously the refunds are income sensitive. And so that's sort of like this backdoor way that we introduce income sensitivity into the property tax arena. But I'm wondering if there's any way to do it upfront. I think that in my community, you hear sometimes about someone who's, a senior on a fixed income who owns their house, but is kind of trying to balance, so they own an asset maybe that's relatively valuable, but then the income that they're bringing in isn't really commensurate with the level of tax that they owe on the house. So yeah, just wondering if you can speak to income sensitivity on the front end of property taxes.
Mr. Swanson.
Madam Chair and members, Representative Gomez, you kind of you sort of touched on the ways that we do that, and we will get to that in this presentation. Mr. Williams is going to talk a little bit about the property tax refunds. Another way that there is at least some sort of income testing on property tax relief is through another program that we will get to eventually in these slides, that's the senior deferral program. So we'll talk a little bit about that. There is a program in place for seniors meeting certain age and income requirements to defer a portion of their property taxes. you know, beyond those are really the two main ways. I'm not aware of, off the top of my head, of how any other state would do that, but certainly, certainly the levers exist, the mechanisms exist, if that was something that the legislature wanted to do. But it's not, I don't think what you're thinking of is currently in place in any way.
Representative Gomez, any follow-up?
Just sort of a comment, I guess. You know, it was interesting to see Ms. Schill's sort of the overall pie chart and what a significant portion of state revenue is made up by sales taxes, which is the most regressive tax that we use. I think maybe excise taxes are more so, but kind of, you know, and property taxes are also a relatively regressive kind of tax. And so, you know, I guess overall for me, I kind of think that we should be doing everything we can to make our tax code more progressive. And I know that we have been doing that over time, but you know, it's sort of like getting a renter's rebate or property tax refund starting in August doesn't necessarily help if you're kind of struggling throughout the year to make those payments, those quarterly property tax payments, for example, or something. So I guess it's just a comment, right, is that, you know, when we don't use progressive tax tools, then we ask local municipalities and school districts, counties and cities to rely on more regressive tax tools like sales tax and property tax. And overall, I just think we need to move kind of more in the direction of greater income sensitivity, greater progressivity in the tax code. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Gomez. Representative Anderson. Representative Anderson, you have to unmute.
Thank you. Mr. Swanson. Thanks, Madam Chair. And Mr. Swanson, you've explained how most levies are set. Back up in my area, there's been a lot of angst recently about the watersheds and how they set the levies, and some say excessive levies. Could you briefly just discuss how watersheds, which are made up of unelected board members, go about their process of setting a levy?
Mr. Swanson.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, I guess the only information that I can provide just off the top of my head would be that watershed districts are considered special taxing districts. So there are a number of different types of special taxing districts that set annual levies. They have levy authority, just like a city, a town, or a county would. But you know, as far as the maybe giving a little bit more detail, I'd have to really get back to you on that. I don't really have much else to provide right now, but I could try to get you a little bit more information on any differences between how watersheds set their levies compared to maybe how a city or a county would approach it.
Okay, thank you. I would appreciate that.
Sorry about that. Thank you, Representative Anderson. Thank you, Mr. Swanson. Representative Jamie Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I've been thinking a lot about, you know, sort of during this time, this last like year, sort of the fuzziness that now exists as more people are working remotely, and especially for folks who have a second home or a cabin, and you know, looking at the way that we tax those and categorize seasonal recreational property. I just want to make sure that I'm clear on this, that for properties that are categorized as seasonal recreational, they don't actually pay any property taxes to the local community. It's the state tax that they're paying. And I just wanted to clarify that I guess related to that, if you've seen any changes in how folks are categorizing their property with things changing in the last 10, 11 months.
Mr. Swanson.
Madam Chair and representatives, I guess my first, the first thing I would clarify is that seasonal rec properties like cabins, do still pay property taxes to the local jurisdictions. So the only difference, in terms of local taxes for seasonal rec properties would be those levies that are levied on referendum market value. So, I know I mentioned that there are still some sort of old holdovers from pre-2008 that are exceptions to this, but generally speaking, those referendum market value levies are just going to be the school operating referendum levies. So the cabins don't pay that portion of the overall property tax bill, but they do still pay the rest of the tax that's levied at that local level. So they are still paying taxes to the county, city, school district, special taxing districts, township, whatever local taxing jurisdictions they're in. And then on top of that local tax, they're also paying the seasonal rec portion of the state general levy. To the second part of your question, I think you were sort of asking whether or not people are treating their cabins now as homesteads, since there's sort of been a lot of changes to how and where people work over the last few months. That's something that could be happening. I would just note that there is, you can only have one homestead in Minnesota. So if you had been treating your house in Eagan as your homestead and wanted to change that to your cabin somewhere, you would have to give up that homestead in Eagan. So you can only have one homestead at a time. It could technically, your cabin could technically be your homestead, but then your actual house couldn't be.
Representative Jamie, any follow-up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And yeah, I know that you can only have one homestead, but I'm just thinking of folks, with Lakeshore, and I know that folks in my district, so I represent suburban people, so it's not like the property in my district is seasonal recreational, but the people own seasonal recreational property up north, and just sort of thinking about how that's all going to play out as people may be trying to, make the system work as best to their advantage in this kind of weird time. So thank you.
Thank you, members. I don't see any further questions. So I think our next spot is going to be about the property tax programs, if you'd like to continue.
Yeah, that would be me. Once again, Kathy Schill, House Fiscal. Slides 22 and 23 reflect major property tax relief programs. This is a quick summary of selected tax relief programs, including who benefits and how much spending is forecasted for the current year, calendar year 2020, fiscal 2021. Of the dozen or so programs listed on these two slides, more than half are in the jurisdiction of the Property Tax Division, and the rest are in the Education Finance Committee. And let's go over these. The top spender, if you will, is local government aid. That's aid going to cities at $561 million. County program aid is next at $260 million. Going down the slide, operating capital aid and local option revenue aid are both school district recipients. $88 million is for COVID small business aid. That is the aid that was passed in special session 7 last December. This goes directly to businesses. The school building bond agricultural credit at $55 million per year goes to school districts, as does the referendum equalization aid at $45 million to school districts. And then we have the agricultural market value credit at $37 million per year. This goes to all taxing jurisdictions. Next slide, please. On this slide, I'll direct you to the middle of the slide with direct payments to taxpayers. These are the two mainstay property tax refund programs. First, the homestead credit state refund is at $585 million per year. And then the renter's credit, The renter's property tax refund is at $227 million per year, and these are direct payments to individuals. And finally, at the bottom of the slide, you see the CARES Act one-time payments to local governments. This was the $838 million presentation that we gave actually just last week. One more note on this particular set of slides. Of all the tax aids and credits program spending, the top four programs, that's local government aid, county program aid, town aid, and the property tax refund for homeowners and renters comprise $1.6 billion or 77% of the $2.13 billion fiscal 2021 spending. And now we'll turn to Mr. Swanson for a closer look at some of those tax aids and credits for cities and counties.
Madam Chair, members, Jared Swanson with House Research. As Ms. Schill said, we're going to take a little bit closer look at some of those property tax relief programs that she just mentioned on the last two slides, starting with local government aid or LGA. So LGA is a general purpose aid that's available to cities. It's been in place since about the late 60s. The chart on this slide shows the LGA appropriations over the last 10 years. There have been a couple of changes recently. So the 2019 tax bill increased the aid by $26 million in 2020. The aid is set to increase an additional $4 million in 2021, then remain at that amount going forward. Next slide, please. So on the next three slides, I'll try to present a simplified overview of the LGA formula. The goals of the LGA have changed over the years, and with changes to those goals, we often see changes to the formula that distributes the aid. So the last LGA formula change was happened back in 2013, and sort of the basic idea to how aid amounts are determined under the current formula is by this measure of unmet need. So unmet need for each city is determined by the LGA formula by first calculating a city's need, and there are a number of factors that go into determining how much need a city has, and those factors vary by the size of the city, and we'll talk about those on the next slide. But from that, a need amount is subtracted the city's ability to pay. And the city's ability to pay is just the product of the city's tax base times the average city tax rate. Next slide, please. So here are those need measures. So for small cities, the factors that go into determining a city's need are the population of the city and the population density within the city. For medium-sized cities, the factors that go into determining need within the LGA formula is the age of housing stock within the city, the household size within the city, the population decline the city has seen in recent years, and the population density. And finally, for larger cities, the factors that determine need include the age of housing stock, jobs per capita, and population density. Next slide, please. So once a city's need and ability to pay have been calculated, the LGA formula determines the city's unmet need. And if a city's unmet need is greater than its prior year aid amount, that city is going to get an increase in LGA. There is no maximum increase, but from one year to the next, aid can only increase by a certain percentage of the difference between unmet need and the need or the amount of aid the city received in the prior year. So it's often the case that the increase won't fully get the city up to its unmet need amount. That may happen over a number of years. If a city's unmet need is less than the amount of aid it received in the previous year, the aid for that city will decrease. And there is a limit to how much a city can lose in LGA from one year to the next. And that limit is set at the smaller of $10 times the city's population or 5% of the city's levy in the prior year. Next slide, please. There's a smaller LGA program for townships that, after being eliminated, was reenacted back in 2013. This aid is just based on the product of the percent of net tax capacity within the township that is ag property, the total acres that make up the township, and the square root of the town's population. Once this product has been determined for each township, the aid amounts are adjusted proportionally so that the total overall aid amount is equal to $10 million. County program aid, or CPA, is sort of the LGA equivalent for counties. This is a general purpose state aid that is available to all counties. And like LGA, the CPA appropriation was increased by $26 million in 2020, and it's set to increase an additional $4 million in 2021, then remain at that amount going forward. Next slide, please. There are two different factors that determine a county's aid. One of those is a need measure, and the other one is a tax base measure. So the factors that go into determining need within the CPA formula include the age of residence within the county, the number of Part 1 or serious crimes within the county, and the number of households receiving SNAP benefits. And the tax-based portion of the formula is just based off of the county's tax base and the county's population. So Ms. Schill mentioned that there are state aids that the state uses to provide property tax relief. Another mechanism that's used for property tax relief is property tax credits. And one of the credits is highlighted on this slide here, and that's the agricultural market value credit. This credit is available to agricultural homesteads, just the land portion of agricultural homesteads. So this excludes that house, garage, and 1 acre of the homestead. And this is simply based off of the market value of the property. So the credit increases as the value of the property increases, and it maxes out at $490 for homes valued at $260,000 or more. The total state cost of this credit for credits paid in calendar year 2020 was $37 million. Next slide. Another credit is the school building bond agricultural credit. Sometimes you'll hear this referred to as the Ag to School credit. And this credit was established in 2017, and then it was amended by the 2019 tax bill. Again, this applies to ag land, excluding the house, garage, and 1 acre. The credit covers a certain percentage of a property's tax bill that is attributable to school building bond debt. So of the total tax bill applied to an agricultural property, if any portion of that is going to pay off school building bond debt, this credit reduces that amount. So the original percentage was 40%. The 2019 tax bill increased that up to 70% over 4 years. So the current, the credit amount for taxes payable in 2021 will be 55%. Next slide. There are a number of other credits and aids that we're not going to cover in detail in this presentation. It's good to know that they exist. They are under the purview of this committee. If you are looking for more information on any of these aids and credits or any of the aids and credits that we've talked about already, you can find them in the handout that Ms. Schill referenced at the beginning of the presentation. And now I'm going to pass it over to Mr. Williams, and he's going to talk a little bit about property tax refunds.
Next slide. Chair Joachim and members. My name is Sean Williams from House Research Department. I typically staff individual income taxes for House Research, but I also staff the property tax refund program because, as I'm going to describe, it's a little bit different than some of the other property tax programs. So the property tax refund program, there's two programs, we've discussed them a little bit already, the Homestead Credit State Refund and the Renter's Property Tax Refund. They provide property tax relief to both homeowners and renters who have property taxes that are high relative to their incomes. They're programs that are sort of based on setting a threshold percentage of your income, and the amount of a refund you get is equal to a percentage of the tax above that threshold, and then there's maximums established for everyone. These programs are a little bit different than some of the credits that Mr. Swanson has talked about already because These aren't applied directly to your property taxes and don't appear on your property tax bill. They're instead refunds that you apply for directly from the state. And so they come back to you sort of after the fact. Next slide, please. As you can see, total property tax refunds were about $719 million. And those are refunds filed in 2019. You can see that homeowners are a larger share of the program at $502 million and renters are at about $217 million. And homeowners are also a larger number of total filers. Next slide, please. The program limits, those are adjusted for inflation each year. So for refunds to be filed in 2021, the maximum income that you can have to still qualify for a homestead credit refund is $116,180. And the maximum refund that you can receive under that program is $2,840. And those refunds scale down, the maximum refunds scale down as income increases. For the renter's credit program, the idea behind this as a property tax program is that there's sort of an assumption made in law that a portion of the rent that renters pay is represents property taxes. So statutorily, property taxes are assumed to be about 17% of rent, and then a similar formula is applied for renters as is applied for the homeowners. The maximum household income that can qualify for this for the renter's credit is $62,960, and the maximum refund through the program is $2,210. Next slide, please. There's also a third property tax refund program that's a little bit different than the other two. This is specifically targeted at homeowners with more than increases in property taxes that exceed 12% in year over year. This is not an income tested program, so household income is not a factor in how much refund you get. And the maximum refund through the program is $1,000. For returns that were filed last year in 2019, there was $9.6 million in total refunds. This program is obviously relatively small compared to the other two, and it fluctuates quite a bit depending on the trends in property taxes statewide. And that's it for the property tax refund program. I'll hand it back to, I believe, Mr. Swanson.
Madam Chair and members, Jared Swanson with House Research. So there is one more property tax relief program that we want to touch on, and this is not an aid, a credit, or a refund. This is a separate tool that the state uses to provide property tax relief, and this is the Senior Citizens Property Tax Deferral Program. So the way this program works is that seniors 65 or older who have a household income of less than $60,000 and have lived in their home for at least 15 years can apply for a deferral of a portion of their annual property taxes. So participants in the program pay an amount of their property taxes that's equal to 3% of their household income, and the balance of their property tax bill is paid by the state. And this is not a credit or a refund, so the state treats this as a low interest loan, and that loan must be repaid before the owner of the home wants to transfer the title. Enrollment in the program would terminate if the homeowners died, if the homeowner sold the property, if the property was no longer the homestead of the owner, or if the owner just decided they no longer wanted to defer a portion of their property taxes. Next slide, please. So this chart illustrates the property tax burden by population quintiles, meaning each bar represents 20% of the state's population, with the first quintile representing the lowest earning 20%, of residents, and the fifth quintile representing the highest earning 20% of residents. So the burden here is measured by effective tax rate, and in this case, effective tax rate is the tax paid divided by the taxpayer's income. So tax is said to be regressive if the effective tax rate falls as income increases. And you can see that with the gross property taxes before any property tax refunds are paid, this is the case. So if the effective tax rate does fall from the first quintile to the fifth. If you were to just look at the blue bars, this is the net property tax paid after the property tax refunds have been applied. It does mitigate some of that regressivity within the property tax. Next slide, please. So the next chart shows how much of the total net property tax each quintile pays. Again, these are the same quintiles, the 20% of the people within each group. The highest earning
quintile. The fifth quintile pays just over 50% of all property taxes, and those tax amounts, those tax percentages fall by quintile down to the first quintile, which pays just over 5% of the total property tax. And Madam Chair, I understand this is maybe a good time to take a few questions before we do the final portion of the presentation.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Swanson and Mr. Williams. Members, are there any questions on this portion? I see two hands raised. Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Joachim. The thing that is, I appreciate, first of all, the presenters with the information here. It's very educational for me. One of the things is, as I was listening to the presentation, first of all, on the property taxes, and then taking a look at the refund program that's available for homeowners and renters, I feel like there's a bit of disparity that I'm starting to see here. And the way I'll call it out is, it feels to me like, as I take a look at the a homeowner who's got a homestead versus a renter who's renting a house in one of the cities, a single family home, and if both properties are $200,000 each, the homestead person would pay an average of $2,350 in property taxes, if I saw the one chart earlier, and the renter would pay $2,921 in property taxes. And when I say that, I'm recognizing that the property taxes are part of the rent that they're paying. And so if the property taxes were lower, the rent would be lower. So I'm kind of operating off that philosophy there. So when I take a look at the property tax refund amounts that are out there, people are homeowners applying, they have a wider income limit, and it feels like they get a bigger credit for property taxes that they would have paid directly, versus if somebody was a renter, it feels like, you know, they're already paying higher property taxes, but their income that they're able to have get a credit on is substantially lower than what a homeowner is. And I'm taking a look at, if somebody who owns a home is earning $57,000 a year versus a renter who is renting a property that is $200,000 a year and has the same income at $57,000, the renter is actually having to incur more property taxes and less of rebate that's going in there. My understanding, you know, and maybe that's a little complex, but as I'm looking at it, that's what I feel like I'm seeing there. Is that somewhat of an accurate statement?
Mr. Swanson or Mr. Williams, who'd like to take that?
Chair Joachim, Representative Fisher, I think it's accurate to say that the property tax refund program for renters has a lower income threshold than the property tax refund program for homeowners. And then the homeowners program has a higher maximum than the renters program. So, and I think that if you go through and kind of, the income brackets for the two programs aren't exactly the same, but I think that it's relatively more generous on the homeowner side relative to the renter side. And I think that Mr. Swanson can confirm, but the class rate paid by apartment buildings would be higher than the class rate paid by homestead single family residence that the homeowner owns. There's sort of a complicating factor in the math that you're doing, because the renter's refund is not assessed or is not calculated based directly on the amount of property taxes paid by the unit or the building. It's instead based on this sort of assumed percentage of rent that represents property taxes, which is 17%. And so you kind of would have to do the math to see exactly, in terms of actual property taxes paid, how much the person is paying versus getting the refund. So it's a little bit more complicated calculation, I guess I'd say, but I think the general picture you're painting is accurate.
Mr. Swanson, did you have anything else to add? Representative Fisher, did you have a follow-up?
Yeah, I know it's more complicated. That's what I was doing here, is I was putting to pencil the rent, so it would come out as the 17% figure, and that's how I backed into the income levels of the $57,275 and the percentage, and figuring at that point the what we take a look as housing should be about 30% of a person's income. So I did all those kind of calculations and coming up with some of this, but I do know that there are other things that enter into the equation, but it does feel like we do give a as I'm listening this, that if you own a home, not only do you get the interest rent, but you're going to pay less in taxes and you're going to get a bigger property tax refund than somebody who's a renter in the program, who a lot of times renters have not always, but renters are typically people who have got lower incomes than homeowners.
Thank you, Representative Fisher. Representative Gomez.
Well, Representative Fisher's point and question was actually a perfect segue, because what I wanted to ask was, Mr. Williams, if you could explain what the policy rationale is for the difference in those income phase out levels between renters and homeowners who are claiming the property tax refund. Like, is there any reason for it, or is it just something that happened somehow?
Mr. Williams.
Chair Yokeem and members, I guess one disadvantage of having fewer longer tenured staff here than we've had in the past on the tax committee is that I can't really speak, I guess, to the kind of long-term decision-making that's led to this sort of those disparities. I could offer to provide some maybe historical research to you on sort of how the two relative amounts have changed over time and how they compare. But I don't have any information, I guess, on the rationale that led to the legislature establishing different schedules for those two programs.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. I know we have an excellent team, but we lost a couple of our longer tenured staff up there over the last few years. So that would be great, just trying to understand kind of where that came from. I also have heard, honestly, I can't remember like where I've heard this, but I know that I don't believe that I've seen actual data on it. But I've heard that there are, based on their incomes and the amount of rent that they pay, there are a number of renters in Minnesota who don't claim the property tax refund because it is this freestanding, like separate form that you have to fill out. You have to get like a certificate of rent paid from your landlord. So that step has to happen. And then you have to kind of like wait till August, which is outside of the tax sort of time when we're maybe thinking about taxes more, back in April. And so I don't know if anybody tracks that, or if somebody has an idea about whether that's just like a thing that I heard / made up, or if that's for real.
Mr. Williams.
Chair Yukim and Representative Gomez, I just pulled up an old email that I've sent on this topic. I have numbers from the Department of Revenue that about 2/3 of the homeowners that are eligible for the homestead credit refund claim it. And they say that they don't have a firm number on the renter's credit because it's a lot harder for them to get data on renters. But they have indicated to me in the past, the Department of Property Tax Research has, that they actually think that the participation in the renter's credit is actually a little bit higher.
Representative Gomez, follow up?
That's great. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Hertas.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and to this interesting discussion about the renter's credit. Thank you, Mr. Williams, for pointing out that the difference in the calculation is based not solely on income for the homeowner. It's, you know, based on a formula based on the value in the tax assessed, where there's an assumption that the credits that are being issued at a given location in an apartment building is solely based on the incomes of those tenants. So I'm just curious, when you made that statement, has anybody ever studied whether or not there's actually more renter's credit paid out on a particular apartment building based on the number of units and the occupants in it? Is there more credit paid out than actual property tax collected? It'd be an interesting thing to entertain.
Mr. Williams.
Chair Yokeem and Representative Hertas, I haven't seen that particular calculation, but I think that the Department of Revenue has done a historical study on what they assume to be the share of property taxes that is represented in rent. And I think the most recent study was from 2018, and they said statewide it was about 13.9%. So I think that there is some research that would indicate that the amount of property taxes sort of that is the underlying assumption for the program is higher than the amount that's actually paid, but that's a couple years old. I would say it's unlikely that they've paid out more refunds than there were property taxes paid, just because the way that the program works, there's sort of thresholds and there's co-pays for the homeowners. So it seems like even with maybe a little bit high estimate of total property taxes in rent, you still would not get refunds exceeding property taxes paid. But I certainly am not aware of that on particular buildings or any sort of systematic way to study that.
Representative Hurtas, you have a follow-up?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Williams. I knew that. I just wanted you to say that. But nonetheless, it appears that with the studies that have been done, we have been generous with regard to the renter's credit. There's been a lot of back and forth over the last many bienniums as to the percent that is assigned to the renter's credit. And as you mentioned, currently we're sitting at 17% for a renter's credit, and the property tax being 13.9%. It's kind of the average yield. So I guess that obviously it depends on location, and that's the three rules of real estate: location, 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 and that's where the taxes get assessed the highest on the most desirable locations, and not a lot of tax on some of the other ones. So certainly I've seen a broad disparity. You could take a home in a rural county in a nice town. I'll just grab one. Let's say it's Glencoe. And if you picked that house up and moved it into Edina, that very same home on the same lot, it would be assessed a much higher valuation. And yet, if the income wasn't dramatically different, if somebody was earning whatever, I think I'm trying to draw the correlation here is that the burden or distribution of property taxes is set at the local level, so they don't need to raise that much. But obviously, Chair Joachim's community, Hopkins, you'd see a much higher property tax on a small home in downtown or rural Hopkins or city of Hopkins than you would if you moved it further out. So, you know, it's a complicated system. And to all you freshmen that are new to the committee, welcome to the most challenging committee with regard to figuring out who pays their fair share.
Thank you, Representative Hurtas.
It's not your fault. I don't have the raise hand icon here, so I don't know what I'm doing wrong, but if I could ask a question.
If it's not under participant, it could be under reactions if you have a newer Zoom model. So
okay.
Go ahead, Representative Green.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, the questions that are coming up are really good. I like to hear these questions because I've dealt with property tax for quite a while. Even though I haven't served on this committee, I used to serve on local governments. And it does point out, the questions that have been asked do point out that we really need to be careful when we pass laws that mandate down certain things to local governments and also to school districts and stuff like that, because the only option that they have is for property taxes. And so when we mandate these things to them, they're forced to raise their levies, which causes more problems, and we're ended up giving more out in local government aids, and it gets to be kind of a nasty little circle. Also, the question with the state property tax, and I'm glad that was pointed out, because that is a double tax. You're taxing people twice on their property tax. Of course, one portion goes to the county and the local level, and the other one goes to the state, and it's pretty unfair. One other thing is the renter's certificate of rent paid is something that landlords have to send out. So it's not something that they have to request. If they're not getting that certificate of rent paid, then they need to check into that, because that should go out automatically. And the one last thing is, if you, we're talking about some of the senior citizens, and I know I've talked to the chair a little bit about this as far as looking at a way to freeze property taxes for certain individuals and then having it put on the property after the property is transferred or sold. Because if you look at our situation in greater Minnesota, you see an awful lot of property tax forfeit lands out here. And when those property taxes are forfeited, or those properties are forfeited, and no longer generating property tax for our counties, then the tax goes up on everyone else to make up the difference, because the services are still the same. So I think we're going to be having some really good discussions in this committee, and at that I will I will let you guys continue. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Green. Ms. Hagler, I believe you're next, and I'm looking at the time, and I was wondering if you could just go over the next two slides, and then we'll take some brief questions on those and then adjourn. So go ahead, Ms. Hagler.
Oh, actually, I believe these, Madam Chair, these two slides are still Mr. Swanson, the fiscal disparities, so he'll probably wrap up for the rest of the day.
Thank you, Ms. Hagler. Sorry about that. Mr. Swanson.
Madam Chair and members, just before we wrap up really the property tax related portion of this presentation, we want to cover two more items that fall under the purview of this committee. The first one on slide 41 is just the fiscal disparities program. There are two of these programs in the state, one in the metro area and one up on the Iron Range. These programs involve a partial sharing of commercial industrial tax base among the areas in which they operate. The calculations involved in these programs are complex, and we're not going to get too far into them in this presentation. But if you are interested in more information on these, we do have an in-depth overview on our website, and I'm also available for any questions on this topic as well. Next slide, please. And the last thing that we wanted to touch on that's property tax related is the production tax. So the production tax is the tax that the mining industry pays in lieu of property taxes. In 2020, about $115 million was paid by mining companies in the production tax. This tax is calculated by applying a rate which is indexed to inflation. In 2020, that rate was just over $2.81 per taxable ton. And the tax base that that rate gets applied to is a three-year rolling average of taconite production by all of the mines. So the tax revenues from this tax get distributed through a formula to a variety of different jurisdictions within the taconite assistance area. And Madam Chair, that concludes the property tax related topics within this presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Swanson, and thank you, Ms. Hagler, for being willing to go on our next committee here next Wednesday. But members, we have about 10 minutes for questions on fiscal disparities and mining tax. So raise your hand in the chat if you'd like. I see Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as long as we have some time, I'll ask this question. Again, it was mentioned about having a production tax, and that got me thinking about a lot of the wind turbines that are now in Minnesota, have been for a number of years. And they, I think, too, pay some kind of a production tax. Is that based on a property tax formula, or how is that production tax figured on the wind turbines?
Mr. Swanson or Mr. Williams?
Madam Chair?
Yes, Mr. Swanson.
I can give a little bit of information on that. So as Representative Anderson said, that yes, the wind and solar energy production facilities in the state do pay a production tax in lieu of property taxes, and this is the tax amount. I believe it varies by the size of the facilities, but the tax amounts are based off of the amount of energy that each system produces.
Representative Anderson, did you have a follow-up? No? Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This goes back to the mining taxes. This is a whole new area for me, and so I've got a question or two on it. When I see that this is the taxes that are collected are paid as in placement of property taxes, does that mean the mine that's in one county, all that revenue that's collected goes to just that specific county, or is it pooled across the region? How is that distributed, and how is it distributed between the county, the school districts, and the cities or townships up there?
Mr. Swanson.
Madam Chair and Representatives, so this the production tax that's paid by the taconite mines is in lieu of property taxes, and it's
Partially it's in place because it's kind of, would be kind of tricky to try to put values on some of these, you know, some of these mines and the land where the taconite is being mined. So what happens is it's, you know, once the production tax is paid by the mining companies, all of that money stays within a geographic area known as the taconite assistance area. And the boundary does not quite follow you know, county boundaries. I think it's actually based off of school district boundaries, but it sort of covers the entire Iron Range area. So the money from a given mine might, you know, it gets distributed throughout the entire taconite assistance area. And there's a formula that distributes these funds. It's not, it doesn't only distribute the money to cities, townships, school districts, and counties. There are also a few other entities that receive distributions of property or, sorry, production tax dollars. And even within a given jurisdiction, like a county, for example, there are multiple ways within the distribution formula that the county receives money. So it's kind of a complex formula, but basically each of the jurisdictions that receive production tax dollars receive a cents per taxable ton share of the overall production tax in a given year.
Follow-up, please.
Fisher, do you have a follow-up?
Yes, I do. Thank you, Chair Joachim. When you mention other taxing entities might be involved with that, would soil and water conservation districts be one of those that would have the opportunity, or are they left out of the pot?
Mr. Swanson.
Madam Chair, Representative Fisher, soil and water conservation districts, I don't believe any of those receive direct distributions of production tax dollars.
Representative Fisher, any more follow-up?
No, thank you.
Thank you, members. I don't see any further hands. Going once, going twice. Not hearing anybody asking any questions. I think this is a good place to start. I want to thank you, members, for your time today, and especially thank nonpartisan staff. As you guys can see, they have tremendous knowledge. So if you still have questions after this, please don't hesitate to reach out to them. Next week, we'll be meeting on Wednesday, January 27th. And currently, the plan is to hear from some of the organizations that will frequently come before our committee. There may be some items added to the agenda as well, so keep an eye on that. And until then, we are adjourned.